Welcome to The Better Picture, where we get close, stay focused, and keep shooting. I'm your host, Ross Foote, and we have a great show for you tonight. In the studio is Gerald Herbert, who will bring some insights into how we get our news photos brought to us. We plan to follow our basic plan, inviting calls from our listeners at any point. We'll have our standard smartphone tip, Molly's Instagram Minute, and a techno tip we'll get from our guests. Remember, you can call in your questions to Gerald at 800-552-8502. Gerald Herbert is an award-winning AP photographer, ranked as one of the 50 most influential photographers over the past 10 years. He's currently working out of New Orleans, but he gets there by way of Washington, New York, Afghanistan, Haiti, and all the other places in the world that we all need to see. Before we start, I do want to take a moment to express my thanks to Gerald for going places I either can't or won't go to bring back accurate images of world events that we, as a free people, need to see. So from all of us relying on you to be our eyes, thank you and welcome to The Better Picture.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Well, I'm glad to have you. Let's start off with a little background on you. How long have you been interested in photography?
Well, it started when I was in high school. It was a way of getting closer to my dad. He developed a hobby, started up a little dark room in one of our bathrooms, and never looked back. Started going to high school football games to take pictures with him, and it was just something that was in my blood.
And did you study it in college?
I did. I went to Boston University. I studied journalism and anthropology, although so many photographers, you don't need a degree. It's just a matter of the drive and the eye.
And do you think the journalism background helped in crafting stories through the lens?
Well, sure. I think that your journalistic judgment gets better as you go along. So the earlier you start, the more honed your perception of what the world is and how you should cover it and what makes a good story, what doesn't.
So you came out of college and went into photojournalism?
Yeah, actually, I started in college. I could say I started in high school. I got published first in the Times-Picayune, shooting some story about Christmas ornaments. Did internships during college with the Picayune, the Baton Rouge Morning Advocate. Worked for the AP as a freelancer through college, and just kind of segued from there.
You know, as a journalist, you get to go to some pretty neat places, and you have to go to some horrific places. Do you have a different approach when you're photographing a president as opposed to a refugee?
Well, they're completely different environments. And covering the White House for the AP, you're covering some very important news, but it's all very controlled situations. You're competing against photographers shoulder to shoulder. If you're in an environment like Haiti or any civil unrest like Pakistan or Afghanistan, your colleagues are also your lifelines, and you're photographing changing circumstances every second, and you're bringing different skill sets to the table in terms of being careful, using good judgment.
And you talk about your colleagues being lifelines. That's literally true. I mean, if you're in a situation in Afghanistan or a war zone, I don't understand how you decide what's safe and what's not.
Well, and first I want to say I've been to some conflict zones, but I don't want to take away from those journalists who do it all the time, who are in war zones and whatnot. I've spent a lot of time in Haiti over the years during the dictatorship and the intervention, the earthquake, elections. I was in Pakistan and Afghanistan after 9/11. But there are people who have and friends who have lost their lives in the process covering these war zones where they're bringing the news home to people back home who need to know what's going on. In Haiti, during all that trouble and dictatorship and the suffering and the political recriminations, it was a dangerous environment, but it wasn't really directed towards the journalists per se. Whereas now, in today's world, if you're in the Middle East, you could get abducted just for being a Westerner. But being exposed to humanity's suffering, all these journalists bond together with each other. They help each other out. No one withholds information if it might have to do with another person's safety.
And so you were in Haiti during the government transitions,
Yeah, in the 90s, covering the dictatorship, and then the return of Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the U.S. intervention, probably, and you have to understand, I was with the New York Daily News at the time, and New York had the second largest Haitian population in the U.S., and it was an important story to them, and the Miami Herald was there quite a bit, and a lot of newspaper photographers were, because there were budgets back then to be able to send their own photographers. And during that time, there was a lot of human suffering and poverty on top of the political recrimination and what was important to the U.S. was that it was right off the coast of the U.S. and refugees were coming over on boats and drowning, and it was quite high drama, and it's nothing that this country can turn a blind eye to.
Well, if you learned your way around during those political era and then the earthquake comes, I mean, did they give you an inside track to get back, knowing the lay of the land, still having contacts?
You know, when that earthquake hit and I saw how big it was on the Richter scale, I immediately called our director of photography in New York, Santiago Lyon, and I had a long history in Haiti, and I said, I need to go. This is really, really bad. And, of course, news was just breaking about this, and he said, go. And first thing I did was call my old colleagues who used to go to Haiti all the time as well, and we were all sharing resources, and we knew that there were multiple ways to get into Haiti if the airport wasn't functioning, mainly through Santo Domingo. And I got in there with some colleagues about 24 hours from Washington, D.C., about 24 hours after the earthquake hit, by going through Santo Domingo and all the way through to the Haitian border, and getting through the border and getting all the way to Port-au-Prince. It was quite an effort.
And so when you walk onto a scene that you were familiar with, and now there are bodies and their destruction, what does that do shift you? I mean, what do you do when you walk upon a newsworthy dead body? I mean, I don't mean to demean it, but...
You do your job, and your job is to report on what's going on, and... I think everyone there, when they first arrived, was just in high-speed mode getting pictures out, because there was quite a lag from when the earthquake hit till there was a stream of images and stories coming out of there. And, of course, the worldwide response, the satisfaction as a journalist is knowing that your reporting is affecting others who are, in turn, opening their minds and their hearts and contributing to try to help alleviate what they were going through.
And I was a judge, and in a courtroom, you kind of hit a zone. You know, once a jury trial starts, the rest of the world goes away. The musicians that go on stage have told me that there are no distractions. You say you walk up upon a scene of devastation, and you just do your job. Does it ever break down? Do you ever suddenly realize, I'm doing my job, but there's a pile of dead bodies in front of me?
You take it home with you. I think everyone's affected in different ways. One thing I've always tried to do as a journalist is to take what I've been exposed to and reflect on the fact of how privileged I am as an American and how the rest of the world really lives and what suffering really means. And I try to formulate it into a positive way so that I live my life in a more full and robust manner and take advantage of the privileges that I have, never losing sight of the people who are suffering.
Well, obviously you've earned some privileges looking at the photographs. And for those of you not driving, if you're sitting at a computer, you can go to thebetterpicture.org and look under the October 27 segment. You can see some of Gerald's pictures that we have there to see the type of thing he's talking about. But one of the things that you'll notice if you go there is you have some very good up-close and close-access pictures of several presidents.
Yes, I covered the White House for 7 years for the AP in Washington, and before that I was with the Washington Times for 4 years. And it's a different kind of reporting. You're up close to some really big decision makers. You're shooting against some stiff competition. You're filing under extremely tight deadlines, often European deadlines. The content of what you're shooting is more canned. When I was with newspapers and going to cover, for example, Haiti or unrest in the West Bank or whatever, you're in the field, you're on the ground. And when you're traveling with someone like the president, you're in a bubble and you're shooting ceremonies and events, but they might be signing nuclear pacts and they're getting front pages all over the world. So covering the White House is more a matter of being a proficient and skilled shooter and being highly organized and getting your pictures out really quickly. And it's a game of inches. You're trying to make a slightly better picture than the other people who are shooting the same thing.
And some of these other photographers that you're rubbing shoulders with, like, say, a matter of inches, I mean, these are friends, competitors, but...
Yeah, in varying degrees, just like any work environment. And we all get along really well at the White House, and it's friendly competition. And, you know, photographers will help each other out, but they're competing against each other.
So the motorcade rolls up, and the president's in the second car, whatever car they let him in. They get out. It sounds like a fire drill. Everybody's...
Yeah, it's an exploitation of the digital technology to the extreme, because you are running and gunning. You're filing pictures from the time if you're on a presidential trip, you'll assemble at Andrews Air Force Base. Well, now it's called Joint Base, and you wait for the president. You're under the wing of Air Force One after you've been screened, and you shoot the arrival. He waves. He might shake hands with some soldiers or somebody, and those pictures, you might be flying somewhere 3 hours away and the president is in the news that day, so you got to crank those pictures out before the plane's at a high enough altitude that you lose your signal, your cell signal. So we developed a very intense workflow where you can get through all these images quickly, file your pictures really fast, and if you don't, and your competition does get their pictures out, if you have a technical problem or you're just slow and they get their pictures out and you don't, you might not get your pictures out for a few more hours, and they could have killed you in play, in particularly European play.
So you've taken the picture, and you've gotten the of Air Force One, then you scurry up the steps, go back to whatever hole they put y'all in. You got to download it, crop it, and dispatch it.
Yeah, we'd have our laptops already set up, our air cards running, caption ready, and you jump in, you scurry up the back steps to the press cabin, you pop your disc in, and you're filing pictures as it's taxiing down the runway. And likewise, you're doing the same thing in the motorcade and the vans going to the event after his arrival. You're doing it from the buffer, the area between the stage and the crowd. You're doing it from there, and then you're doing it in the motorcade going back to the plane, and then you're doing it as you're taking off.
So they let you keep your transmitter going while you're going on the runway, unlike Delta or American or
no comment.
I understand. We have an online question.
We do, Ross. The question is be it a war, earthquake, or whatever the event, is it by inspiration or what? And basically, how do you know which picture to shoot?
You know what your news story is, and it's often a matter of editing. Sometimes you really don't know what you have until you go through your edit and you're finding pictures within pictures and cropping certain ways and finding things. Sometimes the picture you think is the money picture winds up being flat, and then you see something else in your take that you didn't expect that looks nicer. And it's also a matter of working angles and moving away from the pack and just you're constantly trying to find the mood and you're constantly trying to tell the story.
We are at the 15-minute mark, which is when we do our smartphone. I'm keeping it very short today. My suggestion to you on the smartphones is clean that lens every once in a while. It stays in your pocket. It stays in a purse. It picks up gradu. And you may not notice that it's such a short focal length on it, but just take a clean cloth and wipe it clean every once in a while. A fingerprint is going to degrade your picture significantly. Remember, you can call in at 800-552-8502. We are taking questions on that. Talking about events, let's move to another one. It's my understanding that you were in Washington, working for Washington on September 11th, 9/11.
Yes.
And it actually flown back in that day from a covering a sporting event?
Yeah, I came in on a red eye. I was with the Washington Times and came back from Redskins Chargers football game, got in around 3 in the morning, and everything was already packed, and I had only a few hours of sleep when I got the phone call.
And that was the phone call to go to New York.
To go to New York, right. Right, because I had only been in Washington for a couple years. I had been in New York for 11 years before that, mostly first couple years with AP as a stringer and 9 years with the New York Daily News, and I knew the city really well, and I had a strong spot news background. My editor called me and said, go. I jumped in my car. I lived in Alexandria, Virginia, and I was heading to New York when I saw smoke rising from the Pentagon. Well, the buildings of Crystal City were in the way, and they were rising over Crystal City, and I immediately knew that a plane had hit the Pentagon. I've covered several airline crashes, and that's kind of an unmistakable plume of smoke. And I diverted, and I estimate I was at the Pentagon around 10 minutes after the plane hit. As people were still streaming out of the building, and there was a triage area, and the radio report, the WTOP, was just as I was parking my car, they were saying that they heard reports of a fire somewhere near the Pentagon, and here I was staring at the Pentagon fully involved.
On your way to New York.
Way to New York, yeah. I called my editor. I said, I think they hit the Pentagon. You better get some people over here before they close the bridges. And I spent that afternoon covering it. And then that night I went to New York, and then I was covering Ground Zero in New York activities for the next couple weeks. And then by October 11th, I left for Pakistan and Afghanistan.
Well, so they've shut down the airports. Transportation and communication are a mess. You get to New York. What do you do?
I went straight to Ground Zero. And the first day I got to a building that overlooked it, and I shot from there. Probably should have worked it harder. The second day I got to Ground Zero itself. There were roadblocks, and I remember there was a backhoe going down Broadway, and Broadway was completely blocked off. And the reporter and I said, come on, let's jump on this. And we got a ride with the Con Ed guy, got through two roadblocks just riding on the backhoe, and he took us all the way down. He even lent me his hard hat, which allowed me to stay at the scene for a little while, and made some images there. And it was hard to fathom, because I used to have assignments in the World Trade Center all the time. I remember I did a story on window washers, and I went in a bucket off the side of the World Trade Center with a window washer. And last sight of New York, when I was going down the Jersey Turnpike moving to Washington, D.C., I remember looking at the moon hanging over the World Trade Center, and I just remember it hitting a chord in me. And to see what it had become and what happened to America was just so incredibly powerful. You know, something you'll, again, you have it helps me develop a much stronger appreciation for what I have doing the job that I do.
Well, help me understand when you get there by hook or by crook and you're down and you're doing your job and you're stifling any sentiment. Like you say, you're doing your job. You take a bunch of images. Do you get to create the story of what's used? Are you sending batches back and some editor picks out what Gerald's doing?
You can imagine on a story like that, they're going to be using lots of pictures. So I'll take my edit and I'll narrow it down to the best images and I keep filing them. And so they have a larger take to work with and then they can narrow it down from there. But I do edit in the field.
Great. We've got a phone call coming in.
Yes, we do. This is Kathy from Pineville. Kathy, go ahead with your question.
Kathy, you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah. What's your question?
My question is this for Ross. In the 70s, your brother Lee took some pictures of me, and I found the slides today, and I was wondering how I could take those slides and make them into the pictures again. I can't find the pictures. My mother, Curtis Cox, laid at her house, and that's where I found them.
Well, you're actually in luck because now if you have the slides or the negative?
I have the slides.
Okay. You can have those scanned. They're commercial places. I don't know the ones in Alexandria or Pineville, but you can have those scanned. And if you do, make sure you ask for what they call a high-resolution scan. And they literally turn it into a digital form that you can email, you can print, you can put on a little SD card and go down to Walgreens and print them. Gone are the days where it was very hard to make those transfers. So if you've got the slides, which is a wonderful way to preserve the images, go have them scanned. And you can, from there, it's printing just like you take it out of your point-and-push camera or your cell phone now.
Because I also have the slides of the trip that she took to Europe in 1980 with Dr. Bowman to Austria, Switzerland, and Germany. And I'm going to bet
that if you have slides, I'm going to bet that they're Kodachrome, which are just beautiful old antiques now, and I'm going to bet you that the colors are still fat and rich and will scan up beautifully. So take them down and get them done, and once it's digital, you can have them printed any size or any shape you want.
Like, we don't have the camera anymore, so.
You don't need the camera. If you have the slides, Google in slide scanning and backup because you'll get flooded by 6,000. But if you put in the regional areas, somebody locally probably knows how to do it. Get on Facebook. All right. Thank you, Kathy. Okay, we're back with Gerald on talking about how he brings things to life for us. And as I said in my introduction, he goes places that we either can't or won't go so that we know what we have happening in the world. And if the picture's worth 1,000 words, we get to make our own judgment. But to do that, we have to make sure that what we're getting is accurate. Just like I mentioned to Kathy, you can scan things, do anything you want to it. You can alter, you can change, and you don't always get the real picture. So, Gerald, how do we know what we're seeing in the paper, or on the internet, on the news? How do we know that that's right?
That's an excellent question. And the landscape of the news industry has changed so much in the digital revolution that people are getting their news from or their information from multiple sources way beyond the traditional news media. And a lot of these sources can be inaccurate, false. Images can be doctored and manipulated so easily on any computer. Anytime a storm comes through, there's some picture that goes viral, and they say this was from this storm, and it turns out it's from somewhere else in a different part of the world at a different time, but people accept it as truth. And the beauty of journalism is that it's a vetted news source where people's careers and companies, news organizations' complete identity are specifically attached to the truthfulness and accuracy of their product. If someone commits journalistic fraud, they're fired and they will never be used in the business again. A lot of information that people get now, and the Associated Press, for example, is has very clear statement of news values and principles that every employee has to abide by. And photography-wise, there can be just normal cropping and toning. You can't add an element to a picture. You can't take an element out of a picture. And that's something that every photojournalist goes by as a golden rule. But there are a lot of people out there submitting material to news organizations or putting it out online that is completely manipulated. I just saw recently in a newspaper in the Midwest some pictures that were user submitted of the lunar eclipse, and the primary picture they used on their webpage was completely fabricated. There were clouds behind the moon. How that got through those editors, I don't know. But I'll tell you what's been happening to the news industry. It's been very decimated because it's shrunken so much because of lack of revenue that news organizations, many are just a mere shell of their former selves, and they're very undermanned. You go into any newsroom in the country this day and you'll see nothing but empty desks everywhere. There's so many great journalists who have been laid off, who are either out of work or moved on to other careers. And the public has to be very careful in the information that they're looking at, photographs and text, and the public needs to vet it themselves before they recirculate it, because the fact-checking and the vetting that is normally done by us in major news organizations, a lot of that's happening outside of our information stream, and they've got to do the fact-checking themselves.
So when we see a photograph in the paper and it's got the AP credit down at the bottom,
it's the gold standard. And the AP, and not only that, even how you shoot stories and how people write stories. We don't work for publishers who are politically active in the community. Often newspapers are owned by people with very strong political opinions, and the newspaper editorial policy reflects that. The AP is the largest news organization in the world. The tagline is that over half the world's population sees AP material on a daily basis. And all our clients run the gamut, and we have to be the gold standard of accuracy and fairness, and we try to take it right down the line. As we shoot stories, for example, if you're on a campaign trail or if you're covering a politician, we don't lampoon the candidates by trying to make them look silly, and we don't glorify them by trying to put out the product that would please their handlers the most. We try to produce a repertoire of good and accurate images that reflect what they're doing and the campaign and whatnot.
If you want to know how the photographers take care of people on the campaign trail, call and ask. 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502, and we are here to answer those questions. And that's a very interesting point as to not just vetting for the truth, but how you present it. The advice that I've always given or heard given was be nice to the reporter, but be real nice to the photographer. I mean, they can hurt you real quick.
Well, the main thing is that sometimes an image can present something, look like it's something that it's really not. And it may not be reflective of the mood of the event. And I'll give you an example. Sometimes, you know, we self-edit even by not shooting the frame. I remember there was a White House press briefing during the Bush administration, and Tony Snow, the White House spokesperson, had a recurrence of cancer. Dana Perino had press gaggle in the morning. The press gaggle is off camera. Everyone reported that she cried. You know, they were very close. It was a coworker. The guy was fighting a valiant fight against cancer, and he was really loved within that administration. And everybody was there with their cameras for the press briefing, which often we don't shoot. She handled herself beautifully and admirably. She didn't cry. There was one moment when the finger went to the eye, and I'm sure it was just like an itch or something. And I saw it coming, and I didn't even pull the trigger because it was not representative. And I heard some cameras flying, and I saw that picture run. And personally, I just felt, you know, that wasn't fair. It wasn't accurate. I have to answer to that later. You know, we hold ourselves to pretty high standards.
Well, when the photographers get back together and you talk about, you know, the gaggle and you're there and you may or may not be covering it, I would imagine there's a lot of downtime. I mean, when, in a political event, you're not on their, I mean, you're on their schedule. They're not on yours.
Yeah, it depends on the White House schedule. The AP had two shifts for the photographers. We had the morning shift, who was the primary photographer on the White House, and that photographer did all the travel for that month. And then you had the evening shift, where it was part babysitting. You stayed there until they closed the press room at night. And a couple times a week, you'd have an event in the East Room, like a cultural event or something that you covered. Or they'd have a state dinner that night, and you'd be on one of the arrivals or something. So there's downtime, but there's also, it's more than made up for by lots of action. There's overseas trips you go on, and that can be pretty exciting.
So does Air Force One fly smoother than the other planes?
they serve better lunches.
Exactly. Are you cramped in as small as you are on the current flights?
No, my complaint was that the seats were too wide. They weren't like the ergonomic business class seats that you have now. They're kind of like the old-fashioned, big, wide leather seats. And if you try to take a nap on a long flight, you keep sliding sideways. And
you're probably not going to get a lot of sympathy from people today.
No.
So we have a call?
We do have a call. This is Chris from Shreveport. Chris, go ahead.
Hi. I'm teaching a photojournalism class at Northwestern this coming spring. And I have a background in photojournalism between degrees and all that. My question is, for the new students coming in to photojournalism, graduating J school and wanting to shoot, what do you feel is one of the things that they're ill-prepared for?
You can't replace good news judgment. And one thing I notice about people coming into the business is their portfolios and their websites might look pretty slick, but it's often lacking in content. Not their fault, just the access to the stories they've been able to work on, and they're still developing. One thing that's essential now is that you're not just a photographer, but you're multi-platform. You have to be able to shoot video, shoot and edit video, shoot stills. You might even have to interview sometimes, or you know, there are times for the AP where we work cross-platform. For example, during the oil spill, there were times when I covered all four platforms. I shot stills, video, phoned in reporting for on the scene for a print story, and then phoned in a radio report for AP Radio. You have to be versatile to survive in this business, and many journalists are retooling themselves in that regard.
So basically, they need to actually be able to not just take the picture and write the one or two sentence caption, but actually be able to be the only source of that breaking news story or whatever event they cover.
Yes, I see TV reporters carrying their own cameras. TV reporters have to learn how to shoot video. Still photographers have to shoot video regularly for newspaper websites. You have to be a storyteller, and you have to be able to tell that story through multiple platforms. So you have to get comfortable with that. You have to be able to write, speak, edit, shoot video.
Basically, it sounds like they're going to have to go out and get some real-life experience and know how to digest it down.
Yeah, and that comes with being in the business. You know, we all start out somewhere.
Okay, well, appreciate the call. It's time now for Molly's Instagram Minute, which is interesting because Molly's tied up, but she sent one in, being the trooper that she is. She says, you have to remember that Instagram shots are square, which creates a different way to use framing. A rectangle shape starts by giving some movement to the photo, either vertical or horizontal. The square does not. So create some. Great way to do this is load a corner with a solid image. Don't put yourself in the middle of the shot. Use your face to bleed off into a corner and direct the action back into the middle with a glance. That way you can suck people into the picture, make them look in. A little thought about how the viewer's eye will move will make a more interesting picture. Thank you, Molly, for that. We hope your meeting is going well. Let's shift over at this point in time. Not only are you covering the presidents and the rest, you're a sports photographer.
Yes.
And you have done college football. You've done college baseball. Is there a sport you haven't covered you want to?
You know, the sport that I knew the least about as an adult, I thought I excelled at the best. My favorite sport was shooting baseball. I had the privilege when I was at the New York Daily News of covering the Mets and the Yankees. And speaking of shooting sports, New York has 9 professional teams to cover. You've got 3 hockey, 2 baseball, 2 basketball, and 2 football. And what a hotbed for sports. And I had the privilege of covering World Series, several Yankees World Series. I covered, got to cover an NBA Finals. The U.S. Open was there. I learned to cut my teeth in so many ways at the New York Daily News.
Well, one of the mantras that I've heard is you can't watch the sport and photograph it. You have to be tuned into your camera as opposed to just watching what's going to happen.
Yeah, and you kind of stop being a fan, too.
Yeah. And you're currently working with the Saints organization, or the AP, but I mean, you're
covering
the Saints, right. And in doing that, you're both shooting and, as I understand, editing the other shooters that bring to you.
Yeah. For Saints coverage, it's quite a big operation, and we have 2 shooters on the field, an editor, and this goes around all over the NFL. For the AP, we'll have at least 2 shooters, an editor, and 2 runners to bring the discs back and forth to the workstation. We have been using this wireless system where the cameras are tethered to a wireless transmitter that sends to an access point to the roof of the Superdome. That access point is connected to fiber optic line that comes down to my editing station. And the images are coming off the camera to my editing station. We've had varying degrees of success and failure with that because there's a lot going on in that dome that can interfere.
So you're at the dome, but you're in a little room in the back looking at pictures.
Yes, I call it my padded cell.
And for us to see the 1 or 2 images that make it to the paper as an AP picture, how many do you have to look through?
I probably go through 10,000 images a game. I couldn't even tell you. It's like drowning in images, and you never feel like you're caught up. And it's a race against the clock. And again, workflow is everything. I distill it to, I will move 200 to 250 images before I even leave the stadium. And that is cropped properly, toned properly, captioned impeccably, and transmitted. It's a lot of work to go through because those images have to wind up in our archives fixed and correct. And we don't want mistakes or sloppy archives.
So after you've boiled down 10,000 or so images to 200, as they come off of your computer, that's the final archived version?
We file, AP has kind of a 2-tier thing. We have the traditional wire, and then we have expanded content called Live Archive. So those are outtakes, second looks. Sometimes the same images crop looser so that someone has an option to play with that image to fit a hole. And but we file them to FTP sites, and then if it's for the wire, we have a team of editors in New York who go over and check for mistakes and whatnot, and they have our backs because we make mistakes, and it'd be hard to function without them. And they likewise play an unappreciated role in the business. Nobody knows how many people go into putting out this kind of material in a big news organization.
But that's why the AP signature means something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you've done that. Well, let's go down to the shooting. I don't think
shot?
No, shooting the shots
I got to go.
Right, shooting the shots, right, pick up his camera and run. on the field, you're down close enough to get run over, and you're looking through a viewfinder with a couple of thousand pounds of padded man running at you. What's that like?
It's not hard because we're behind a yellow line, which is behind a white line, which is behind the boundaries of the field. These are very talented athletes at this level, and they can stop on a dime. And football, people get hurt. There are times when people got hurt. I remember one that sticks in mind was a former AP photographer, Susan Reagan, got bowled over on the sideline of a Super Bowl and got injured her leg. I used to cover the Devils hockey team in Brendan Burton Arena, which became Continental Arena, and I don't know what they call it now, but that was a dangerous place to shoot. It's one of the few hockey arenas where the photographers were right next to the player's bench with no plexiglass between them, and I got clocked in the face once. I remember it was Greek Easter, and I had to go to Connecticut to meet my girlfriend's family at the Greek church because they were Greek Orthodox, and I remember showing up with about five little butterfly Band-Aids all over my face. Everybody was snickering in the church. Everyone wanted to know the backstory. I couldn't tell them until we got out. Well, I was whispering to them little tidbits, but it was funny.
Well, that's that always amazed me. You see those people duck and cover, and you're right. The athletes tend to jump over and clear it, but I do get concerned for the person that's sitting down there. We have a lot of high school. In fact, Shreveport is very proud of their high school football. All the teams are doing well and produce a lot of people.
In fact, AP covers the high school championships in New Orleans. We cover high school football.
Yeah, and
there's a lot of great.
We tend to send some people down there to play.
And that's one of the things I do also is when the member newspapers come, AP clients, member newspapers from around the state come in for the football, I go as much to shoot some of the games as to help them out because they're in the stadium. It's good member relations with them. We help each other out.
Well, I'm going to turn over the techno minute, which is time for us to do that. I'm going to turn that over to you and kind of put you on a spot. What do you tell the parents of the high school football player that doesn't have the $10,000 worth of equipment that y'all get to shoot with? What advice, what tips would you give?
To make good images of their kids in their games.
To get them.
Okay. The most important thing is if you have a good exposure and your picture is sharp, you can crop in on it pretty well. So, and I would shoot raw format, not JPEG, and work with the raw image. And also, a lot of these games are at night under really poor light, and a lot of amateur cameras don't have the quality ISO gain that our cameras do. I can jack my ISO up to 20,000 ISO. You can't do that with an EOS Rebel. The degradation is too great. I would also recommend going to practices during the daytime and shooting your kids at practices because you want pictures of your kid in their youth having fun. My girlfriend's son plays lacrosse here, and her daughter up until recently did cheer. She's now swimming and competitively. And one of the nicest pictures I made of Artis playing lacrosse was he happened to score the game-winning goal right before end of regulation, and just the moments of his teammates coming up and hugging him and congratulating him. The rules are pretty loose on the field there, so I just ran across the field at the end of game and made some of the nicest pictures of him being congratulated. His mother cherishes those pictures to this day.
Well, I think, and the tip of getting there when you have lots of light. With a lot of light, you can do a lot more things.
Basketball is really hard.
We have a call?
Oh, we do. This is Tia from Alexandria. Tia, go ahead.
I'm a former photographer myself.
Tia Owens Powers.
I am. That's me.
Hi, Tia.
Hi,
wonderful photographer, and she was a great contributor to the AP when she was with the Alexandria Town Talk.
I'm interested in some of the more interesting stories that you did that you covered, where you got to a story and maybe it wasn't what your editor thought it was, because I can't tell you how many times that would happen to me, and you come back with this story that wasn't the story that they thought it was going to be, but it was still a story. So tell me something about that.
Well, it's interesting because it you have to catch yourself, as you know, from dreaming up what kind of pictures might come out of this story. Of course, there's potential, but then when you get there might be reality. Often the story doesn't play out the way you thought. It becomes ho-hum. And likewise, stories that you never thought were going to yield much sometimes surprise you, and you get something really nice out of it. Tempering editors' expectations, I just kind of roll with it and hope that they trust me enough to know that I did my best, and that they are willing to say, okay, well, we tried. It didn't work out that great, but that's okay. And likewise, one of the things I hated the most covering sports was sports editors back at the paper watching TV and saying, "Did you get that? Did you get that?"
Right.
you want to go with your best pictures and let the best pictures speak for themselves.
Right. Okay.
But well, Tia, have you encountered let down from editors when you go shoot something that they thought had potential and it didn't work out that way?
Right. Well, working at a small town newspaper, a lot of times they had the story figured out in their head prior to us going out, and sometimes you go out and come back with something that was a really good story, but it wasn't what they thought it was going to be, and you know, you get into that argument about, well, where is this picture? Well, that didn't happen.
Right. Yeah. And you know, she hits a very good point, because writers can write about things and they can use adjectives and adverbs and dress things up colorfully. And then editors are saying, well, where was that? And, you know, the writer said this happened, and you say, well, it didn't come together in that exact moment. Yes, there was a tear somewhere over there that the reporter didn't see, but someone told the reporter that someone shed a tear, so it goes into the story. For a photo to line up, to have all those elements, it has to be in real time, and it has to all come together. It's like duck hunting, you know? You can come back without... I don't duck hunt, I don't hunt, but I guess that's the best analogy I can use for Louisiana.
Well, and
you can come back with no ducks.
And everybody has their job, and of course it would be a teamwork thing. Well, T, I'm glad you got in. I obviously have a very recognizable voice, because we picked up right away.
As soon as she said Tia, I thought, and she said I was a former newspaper photographer. That pretty much told me her last name.
Appreciate it.
And likewise, Tia was likely the victim of downsizing. The news industry has been another one of those excellent photographers who the news industry's downsizing. There's layoffs every year all around. Entire photo staffs have been laid off. And it's important to point out that in the state of Louisiana, other than the Times-Picayune and the Advocate, who have very large circulation areas, most newspapers in Louisiana now have one or two photographers on their staff, and that's it, when they used to have 8 to 15. And those photographers are trying to cover everything. And in fact, we try to get images from those member newspapers for the AP wire, and we're limited to what we can get because those photographers are stretched out and they're not covering all the things that they used to cover.
Well, by now the audience should have heard the passion that Gerald brings forward to what we can do with pictures and why we need to have the pictures. We have a little time left. If you have a question, call 800-552-8502. One of the issues that kind of along the line of what Tia was talking about, the story doesn't go the way you want to. When you're denied access, the Gulf Oil spill, you go down and you got some amazing aerial photos while the rig's still burning, but then you've got some down in the muck, the birds and all the rest of it. Did you get any pushback from BP or from the governmental sources?
Yes, and that was a battle that I was very proud to be a part of with the AP. And there were increasing restrictions put on journalists that made it more difficult for us to get access to the oil and the effects of the oil on the shore up close, that were imposed by the Coast Guard. likely from the lobbying and pressuring from BP. And at one point, if you were within 200 meters of an oil boom, you could have been charged with a Class D felony and a $40,000 fine. You can imagine the chilling effect that would have.
Right.
And you know that BP and their effort to, control the image, they had a big problem on their hands, and their public relations, it would benefit them for people to not see this, but it certainly benefited the public. The public needed to know what was going on with their shores and up close the extent of the damage. I sent images to our legal team in New York of pictures before these restrictions, and then I honored the restrictions and showed what we could get now. And before, we had up close oil getting into the reeds and the nests and the marsh grass and the on the birds and whatnot, and how thick the oil was, how deep down it went. With the new restrictions, we couldn't, you could see, we were about a quarter or half a mile away from a shore, and if you saw a bird, it was a little speck in the sky. And our legal team and our editors got together, and we fought this battle, and ultimately got these restrictions pulled back.
We are glad you do. I understand we have two calls. Let's take the first one, and we'll see what happens.
We do. This is Kate from Pineville. Kate, go ahead with your question.
Hi. I was wondering about, you were about to talk about the basketball gym pictures, and I want to make sure that that was touched on. I did a yearbook for my school, and that is always a challenging place to be to take pictures.
It is. It's usually low light. It's usually very, very tungsten, which means the pictures come out yellow no matter what white balance you set it on. That's why I would check your camera settings and shoot in the raw format. I would try to shoot under the basket. A lot of times in high school gyms, it means you're leaning against the gym wall under there. Use a short lens, like a 50 millimeter lens, not a zoom lens. Try to get a fixed focal length lens, because the f-stop is much wider, which means it'll let a lot more light in, which means you can get a faster shutter speed at the same ISO. The ISO, the more you crank up the ISO, the greater the sensitivity. So the lower the light, the higher ISO you need to get an adequate shutter speed to stop the action. The problem is that when you raise the ISO, the image degrades. Amateur cameras, there's a threshold that's much lower than professional cameras. So the more light you can get into that lens, the better. Shoot in RAW so you can color correct it best, and get all of that yellow out of it. And sit on the, if you're under the basket, sit to the right of that basket, because they'll be driving usually with their right hand. And if you sit to the left, you'll get more of the arm blocking the faces. And if you sit to the right, you'll get more of the face with the arm going up when they drive to the lane.
Sounds like a person who's been there and done it. We appreciate that. Good luck with those. We have one other call.
Yes, this is Ruben from Shreveport. Ruben, you're on the air. Go ahead.
How are you doing today?
Doing great, Ruben. How are you?
I'm doing great. And you're correct about that basketball. I used to play ball, and it's always best to be on the right because you're driving with your right. So anyway, I'm going from regular normal cameras to digital, and it's getting into a basic camera. You know, is there one? I know one camera is better than the other. You know, I'm looking at the Nikons right now, the 5500 and the 7500. I think they are, because all my cameras I have a Mamiya 645 and a Olympus, and they're like 30 years old.
Those are film cameras, right?
Right.
Yeah, they have film cameras, and they're starting to come apart. And I just hate to give them up, but I'm going to have to.
What are you going to be using your cameras for?
Well, I do a lot of motorcycle riding. I do a lot of traveling. I'm thinking about going with my son-in-law hunting. I'm not a hunter, so I'll be just taking pictures. And I know a click of a camera spooks a deer away, because my daughter goes out there with him shooting it. She scares them away. So it just, just basic photography.
Well, there are some cameras now that don't have the click of the mirror. There's the mirrorless cameras that you can put into a quiet mode, and they just don't make any noise. So that's one of the things that you can look at. The single lens reflex is going to have that clack. It's going to make the noise because it's the mechanical motion of the mirror. But you can look at some of the mirrorless ones that do, and I could start naming brands, but there are a bunch out there.
Oh, yeah.
And depends, and some actually have very good built-in zoom lenses. The technology has changed to the point where you may not have to be changing lenses to get a pretty decent zoom lens. One of the places that I refer people to look at is a place called dpreview.com. It's a British source, but I have found them to be pretty honest and pretty reliable about what cameras do what. Plenty of information out there. Don't be afraid to go to the digital. I was going to keep a foot in both camps. I've shot 140,000 digital images and two rolls of film since I changed. So once you get there, you'll find out it works pretty well. Appreciate the call. Good luck in the decision. Okay, we've got 2 minutes left. I do have a question that I tend to ask most of my guests. Who are the major influences you've had? Are there any photographers that, Gerald, that you've got that impacted how you see through the viewfinder?
Yes. I'll tell you, Carol Guzzi is an outstanding, one of the greatest photojournalists around right now. I had the pleasure of working side by side with her through Haiti. We're comrades, we're friends. She's I think the only journalist who has won 4 Pulitzer Prizes, and it's because she has such a tender heart and a keen eye, and she's dedicated her life to exposing to the rest of the world the sufferings of others. Right now, one of my absolutely favorite photographers is who I think is doing work on the level of Henri Cartier-Bresson, who is also a friend and former coworker of mine, is Astrid Reiken. You can see her on Facebook and Instagram. It's R-E-I-K-E-N. We work together at the Washington Times, and every time I see images of hers, I feel rather small.
You can recognize
as a photographer.
Well, I know the feeling when I look through the
Michael
pictures.
Williamson from the Washington Post is doing some really nice work, travel work, and I could go on and on. Jim Nockwe was always a great one.
I know the feeling because when you sent me the pictures and I looked at them, I realized what was happening. Well, we're running out of time. My thanks to Gerald for taking the time to give us a behind-the-camera glimpse at what we get to see in the news. Thanks also to the excellent staff of the Red River Rio for pitching in after hours to make this work. I guess with a 24-hour station, there's no such thing as after hours. But thanks to all of our listeners. Thanks to the staff. Remember, get close, stay focused, and keep shooting.